From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. In Brazil, the judges who are leading corruption investigations into the country's current and former presidents are getting the superstar treatment.
And all these judges and prosecutors were there in the premiere. They were being photographed just as the actors and actresses performing the movies.
I'll talk with University of Oklahoma Brazil expert Fabio Desai Silva about Operation Car Wash and why Brazil is prone to corruption. But first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss recent elections in Germany and Angola and separatist referenda in Iraqi Kurdistan and the Catalan region of Spain.
We're not sure if either of these are actually going to result in anything, but they certainly are resulting in a lot of uneasiness for those around them.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, we've been harping on elections around the world. Let's talk about elections, big elections this week in Germany. Also some transition going on in Angola. So let's talk about both, but particularly Germany, because Angela Merkel is going to have a historic fourth term. But there were some hard right party gains, I think, and there's some question about the impact of this on Europe as a whole. Tell us about what's gone on in Germany.
Well, just to start with Angola, I think we talked about the elections on the show about a month ago, and what is really noteworthy in that is that there has been a successful transfer of power. So when we think about consolidating democracy, it isn't about the elections necessarily. It's about those elections taking place being free and fair, and that there is a peaceful transition of power. So we are seeing that there for the first time in a couple of decades. So good news. And then if we turn our attention to Germany, yes, this has been a remarkable election. I think we knew that things weren't going to be smooth sailing for the CDU, the party that Angela Merkel is a member of. This is, again, a parliamentary system, so it has to go off of representation and votes gotten. We see, particularly in the East, the AfD gaining 13 percentage points, and that gives them seats in the Bundestag. And this is the first time that what we classify kind of as a far-right group has gotten seats since the 1950s. So that's significant. There's a couple of things potentially going on here. We've talked about the results of the immigration push, the migration push. Germany has been much more open than some other countries, taking in over a million immigrants and refugees since 2015. So some of this is a backlash to that for sure. But we're also seeing this breakdown on east-west lines. We often think Germany has been reunified, that these issues no longer exist. But clearly, they do appear to exist, that there are still people in the East that feel like their concerns have been forgotten, that the refugees have been given more than they've been given, and there still are some policies in place that seem to favor those in the West. So if you look at where the AfD got their votes, it does seem to be primarily in the eastern states, and many of their votes did come from the CDU, from the party in power. So it's kind of a clean shift that goes towards the AfD there. So Merkel has promised to have a government by December. She did not get a clear majority, so they're going to have to form a coalition. We'll see what that's going to be.
Well, very quickly, this has international implications,
absolutely,
too, for Europe as a whole. As I mentioned, the European Union, I mean, Germany is one of its primary leaders now. So what are we to expect there?
This is one of those things. We saw it in France. We're going to see it here in Germany. We don't know what the effects are going to be here, but we will look and see what that coalition government does and if that means any change in policy and if that affects the greater EU.
All right, Rebecca. So in addition to these important returns, we also see some separatist movements developing. This week, Iraqi Kurdistan, the Kurdish part of Iraq, has overwhelmingly supported a referendum to separate. And we see an upcoming vote in the Catalan region of Spain about independence. So we've seen some elections conclude and we see some coming forward.
Yes, the Iraqi Kurds have voted overwhelmingly, as you said, 93% for independence. This has been deemed by Iraq as an illegal vote, and there have been what appear to be retaliation or potential retaliation. Airports have been closed into Iraqi Kurdistan. Others in the area are getting concerned. And then, yes, we will watch in the next couple of days as the Catalan region of Spain votes for independence. This also has been deemed as unconstitutional. So we're not sure if either of these are actually going to result in anything, but they certainly are resulting in a lot of uneasiness for those around them.
And Spain has suggested they will actually use force to prevent this vote from taking place. So,
yes.
All right. Thank you so much, Rebecca, as always, for being here.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU and I'm at Suzette Guerlot. Next, we'll talk with the University of Oklahoma's Fabia de Sá Silva about the ongoing corruption investigations in Brazil. I'm Suzette Guerlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Allegations of corruption continue to swirl around Brazilian President Michel Temer, whose approval ratings have sunk below 4%, according to Reuters. Temer follows a line of presidents who've been clouded by corruption charges, including the recently impeached Dilma Rousseff and Lula da Silva. I spoke with Fabio de Sá Silva about the South American country's problems with corruption. He's a Brazil expert at the University of Oklahoma's Department of International and Area Studies. Fabio de Sá Silva, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you here to talk about Brazil, of course, one of my favorite countries. And one of the reasons why it's my favorite is because it's kind of complicated and interesting in some of the things, the challenges that they're facing today, politically, economically, and otherwise. So we've got these ongoing corruption scandals among the highest levels of Brazilian politicians. Former President Lula has been convicted, actually, of corruption charges and is now appealing that. Former President Rousseff also facing charges. And the current president, Temer, is also accused of corruption but has so far remained in office. And we're talking big time corruption here, hundreds of millions, if not what, maybe billions of dollars that we're talking about being diverted here for individual purpose and use. So, Fabio, kind of set this up for us. What's going on in Brazil? How do we understand these presidential scandals as they're ongoing?
Well, corruption in Brazil is not a new phenomenon. There is, was new in this particular case was the fact that it came onto the surface and people got to discuss it. Unlike moments in the past when whether because of the military dictatorship or because institutions were not so strong, the media didn't have the same degree of freedom it has today. These issues couldn't be properly addressed by the public opinion. There are some other aspects of more contemporary Brazil that make this slightly different issue than it was in the past. One of them is the fact that Brazil actually had a very good moment in terms of its economic development during the past few years, and then the government got to spend more money and make more investments, and of course that amplifies the opportunities for some of the corrupt conducts by both public officials and people in the business sector. Also the fact that the political system in Brazil, technically it's not a bipartisan democracy. You can have independents or you can have people coming from other parties to run for office. But in practice, it gets pretty bipartisan, and you have Democrats and you have Republicans, and the role of the president, because Brazil is also a presidential system, is to search for common ground around the issues that he wants or she wants to advance in his or her agenda. In the case of Brazil, we now have almost 30 parties represented in Congress, so it's very hard for a president to build a coalition in support of his agenda or her agenda. One of the ways that politicians found to take that step was to give positions to representatives of these parties within the government structure. And of course, when they are there, because they want to come stronger in the next elections, they are looking for ways to accumulate more political power, but also more economic resources. Or they search for opportunities to get, kickbacks and to ask for bribes in all the contracts that they handle. So if you put those pieces together, a country that grew economically and that began to make more investments in terms of industrial development and infrastructure, and a political system that was growing fragile in that respect, then you have, you know, more clues to understand what's going on.
I think what I'm hearing is that this country grew so quickly economically that its democratic institutions, like the rule of law, hadn't really kind of solidified enough to perhaps prevent some of these corrupt activities from happening. So on the one hand, the institutions are strong enough to actually work in that way, and it's a good sign. On the other hand, there was too much economic growth and too much opportunity, as you said, too much financial opportunity that the democratic institutions weren't strong enough to prevent the corruption to begin with. Is this something what you're saying, that we perhaps, if the political institutions had grown, if they had been a stronger democracy, if there had been more of a kind of a norm of behavior or some sort of constraint on this kind of corruption before massive economic growth in Brazil, that we might not have seen this sort of thing?
Yes, and perhaps things were coming together. Part of the sources that are being used in these investigations actually come from some of the transparency laws that President Rousseff, for example, advocated for and translated into a bill that was passed in Congress. All the legislation that's been used to accuse all these politicians actually passed during the PT governments. I think that both processes, both the country becoming more economically developed and politically developed, were taking place more or less at the same time. But at the core of it was this issue with campaign contributions and the fragmentation of political parties and all those parties looking for means to get stronger to the next election. And so there was a structural failure that was exposed through these scandals.
Let's talk a little bit about your main area of expertise, and that's on the issue of kind of policy and law, and particularly the role of the judiciary and public prosecutors and prosecution in kind of managing corruption here. Can you tell us a little bit about how the judiciary, the judicial branch, is kind of managing this, and I guess how we envision the judicial role mm-hmm. in fighting corruption?
So you mentioned rule of law and whether what's going on is an indicator of a stronger rule of law in Brazil. And in fact, most of what we are discussing now stems from this corruption investigation that started in 2014. It originally started as an investigation on money laundering. The connection between that and the political system was not clear in the beginning until they arrested some of Petrobras officials who were getting kickbacks for contracts. And these people then, in one of those numerous plea deals that took place within the investigation, revealed that part of the money was actually being channeled to political parties and to politicians. There's a big political role that's being played by the judiciary and public prosecutors in that sense, that they are coming out before the public opinion. And I think even in terms of how they understand their role in democracy, they're coming out as these, moral entrepreneurs that are cleaning the country in some way.
So judicial entrepreneurs, you're basically saying they're
yes.
kind of being entrepreneurial in their
It's a moral entrepreneurship from
activism.
The bench, yeah. So, which has its complications as well. We had a movie that was released, and that's a movie about the Lava Jato, or car wash operation. And all these judges and prosecutors were there in the premiere. They were being photographed just as the actors and actresses performing the movie. So, yeah, they have become superstar in that sense, too. So there's a lot to talk about them and the role that they're coming to play in Brazil politics these days.
How is that affecting the way in which they're actually engaged in the real work of fighting corruption? I mean, because at some point, is it not so much about fighting corruption as it is about themselves and their own role and kind of mm-hmm. Perhaps even solidifying a stronger judicial role in mm-hmm. Brazilian politics?
Yes, that's exactly what I argue in my studies. I think that this is a result of a longer process of the legal profession coming back to play a lead role in government. And this is also something that started with the 1988 Constitution, which was when actually all these legal careers were either created or recreated. So this is when judicial independence was guaranteed, because during the military dictatorship, judges could be removed based on what they were doing, were being liked or not by the government. And many of them were actually wiped out of their seats by the military. But then the 1988 Constitution ensures their role and gives them all the protection that they need to rule. And also creates the public prosecutor's office in Brazil, which is very unique. You don't find anything like that around the world in terms of the protection that they have and the power that they get to file lawsuits, both criminal and civil, against anything that hurts the public interest. So that's like a public interest bar entrenched within the state with all the protections that they think it's important for public interest cases to be brought about. But also public defenders and government lawyers, all those actors were empowered by the Constitution. What happened is that it took a long time for them to actually translate that power and institutional condition into actual lawsuits or investigations that would have a real impact in politics. Brazil was dealing with other issues during this time. Brazil was stabilizing the economy, bringing about social policies that would reduce inequality. But in this meantime, the legal profession was being deeply transformed, and these judges were taking their seats, these prosecutors were taking their seats, and were developing their doctrinal concepts that they would then mobilize in this particular context of this investigation.
So, Fabio, I have to ask, and it's kind of two questions put together. When you're telling us the story about, particularly about the judicial role and the role of judges and prosecutors in fighting corruption here in Brazil, it reminds me of the days of fighting corruption and organized crime in Italy. And judges played a significant role in doing that. But they were also significantly targeted. And there was a lot of violence that was focused on judges and prosecutors for going after organized criminal groups. And that's then what catalyzed the public support to fight organized crime in Italy. Do you see that same type of thing happening in Brazil, where there's any kind of, these judges are threatened in any way, or the prosecutors are threatened in any way of the work that they're doing? And secondly, what is the public response to all of this and support?
I think the first thing that's interesting to highlight is the fact that they themselves feel inspired by the Italian example. There are now books being written about comparing the two. This particular judge named Sergio Moro, who's ahead of this case in the federal judiciary, tells that this is where he get inspiration from as he proceeds with the case. They've put themselves at the center of a controversy. That's gonna create some sort of response. And one of the responses that they got was, of course, that they got support. It's no wonder that movies are being made, to portray them as these heroes or ruthless people who are, going after these corrupts. But at the same time, there are questions about their role and whether they are doing it consistently. So, for example, one of the things that Judge Moro himself did that affected very directly the political crisis is he released conversations between President Dilma and former President Lula to the media. And that really catalyzed the impeachment proceedings against President Rousseff. However, the problem is that he didn't have the authority to tape her. So he had to send that to the Supreme Court. If he came across a conversation where she was involved, it was only the Supreme Court that had the authority to examine that and determine whether there was anything criminal in that. So when he did that, he put himself in a much larger political game. And of course, he would be then, hit as any other politician would have.
What do you see as far as going forward, kind of like the prospects or the hope in the sense that, you know, we will see a new growth in leadership of new leaders coming up that will not repeat these types of mistakes, won't have the same type of opportunity to do so? I mean, do you see that Brazil's moving in the right direction in that regard?
One of the effects that this corruption scandal had was it discredited the entire political system, and that can be bad or good. Right now, what I see is the only people who are taking benefit from the situation is the extreme right wing, especially one of their candidates or would-be candidate named Jair Bolsonaro. He is one who's growing in the polls and who's now, you know, being talked about in very serious way in terms of his intentions of becoming the next president. I do hope that the other political parties will do their jobs and try to find new leadership. PT, of course, has Lula as his icon, and Lula wants to be candidate. We don't know if he'll be able to do to be. If not, I really hope that, you know, PT, PSDB, and all the other more consolidated parties will be able to work out both candidacies and projects that will put the country back on track, because now the overall situation is very bad in terms of the direction that it's taken.
All right, Fabio, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Fabio de Sá Silva. He is a Brazil expert in the University of Oklahoma's Department of International and Area Studies. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced this show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Worlott.